And it's the top of the hour. And welcome this evening to One Lutheran, One Jew, One Hour. I am Sue Belita, pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church, and with me is...
Rabbi Dov Gartenberg.
And while our goal is to provide a safe and civil and open space for engaging dialogue around issues of faith, as we say at the beginning of every show, we do want to emphasize that we do not speak for all Lutherans or all Jews across all time, all places, and all contexts. We do, however, bring our own background, experiences, and perspectives to the conversation. And our topic this evening is the intersection between religion and money, which is often an uncomfortable topic, but does it really need to be? Why can't we talk freely about money? How has money enhanced or distorted our perceptions of faith and faith traditions and institutions? How has your faith or tradition shaped your view of money and how to use it? How has your faith or tradition been broken by the use of money? Give us a call to join the conversation at 463-6455. And so, beginning a topic with many and varied windows to it, where shall we begin, Rabbi Dov?
Well, let's talk about, I guess, how our religious institutions function around money, or the views that we've learned from those faith traditions about how we handle money, see money.
Yeah.
How about that topic?
All right. So, how does money function in the Jewish world?
Well, this is a topic which, of course, has a lot of layers and probably sensitive, certainly sensitive for Jewish people because of stereotypes, anti-Semitic stereotypes. Merchant of Venice, a pound of flesh.
Am I still not a Jew?
And you know, that's a very complex topic, which, if anyone's interested, I'd go into. I think, are looking more really as sort of in our current lives and our relationship to religious institutions, how we feel they, I can share a lot during the hour about issues that synagogues have and Jewish communities have around sustainability, which, you know, involves money, right?
Right.
So. That's a topic, especially in the lower 48. I don't know. I haven't seen Alaska as hot a topic in the Jewish community, but in the lower 48, there's always lots of strong feelings about funding for religious institutions and programs, and what's the best way to do that.
I think there is a real rub between what is my money being used for? And part of that, I do think, is because we have seen misuse. Mm-hmm. Misuse finds its way into the news. And
always,
you know,
finds its way into the news.
It
That's
does.
The first thing you hear.
Exactly. And so, and good and proper use for much of the reality for the majority doesn't find its way into the news. And so I think maybe there's a little bit of a distortion there in our perception of the advantages that sometimes institutions or particular individuals, leaders of those institutions, take in terms of money. But we have a Sunday offering. You know, we pass the plate every Sunday, and I know that's not the tradition in Jewish
synagogues,
worship.
Right. I mean, the way we fund our synagogues in modern times, although there were different ways of funding in earlier times, is through dues, membership dues. And part of the reason for that is that this Jewish Sabbath, which is Friday to Saturday, is a time when we're actually forbidden to handle money. So the way it works in synagogues is you pledge your support through dues, and even when there's an appeal for money, say during the Jewish high holidays, then it's in the pledge form. You would never, it would be very passe, actually, if you were to pass a hat around. I've never been in a synagogue where they passed a hat around. I've been around some synagogues that really don't, are really detached from Jewish tradition, but I've never seen a hat passed around. And it has, that's the memory of even assimilated Jews about not collecting money on the Sabbath.
So that sustainability then is created through memberships and through selling tickets for seats for the High Holy Days?
Right. I mean, most synagogues, you join a synagogue and you, it's prime, most people, well, that's a, I mean, most synagogues have a dues structure, which payment, which it includes sustaining the clergy, sustaining teachers or schools, sustaining other types of, bricks and mortar and those types of things. And then usually synagogue can't be sustainable on dues only, and it has to do additional fundraising, and that's the high holiday seats. So if you're not a member of a synagogue, at least in the lower 48, you would pay for your seats, which is the most controversial modern practice, because many people feel that having to pay to pray is unethical. Although the counter-argument is that the synagogue couldn't survive if it just was allowed free riders, people who wouldn't pay to come to the high holiday services when most people show up to the synagogue. It couldn't survive if they didn't obligate people. But there's a lot of experimentation going on that issue. I've been a participant in that experimentation. Here in Alaska, though, the synagogue up here in Juneau, which I'm familiar with, does not, anyone can come. There's no charge at all. The synagogue dues are low compared to lower 48 standards. And it's funny because I've heard people move down there who've always been here and are shocked. For me, it was shocking to see what they do up here when I moved here. But you know, it's interesting. There have been other systems that existed, actually in Jewish communities, which had a certain degree of autonomy. That all the Jewish residents were taxed in medieval times, and that's how you supported the rabbis and the religious officials, who were also, in a sense, combined secular officials, because the courts were rabbinic courts. And very different system of financing than we have today, at least in America. And, that it's a fascinating issue, even just to think about. But
right, and there are European models even today where, in some countries, for example, the Lutheran Church is the state church and people pay taxes and the pastors are, in essence, state employees. So that is one model.
And Israel follows that as well, the problem being that it supports one form of Judaism, and their religion and money is even more controversial because the money in Israel that supports the state religion, the Jewish, is an Orthodox establishment that is very jealous of the funds and does not recognize the legitimacy of non-Orthodox movements that don't receive state funding. So you can imagine that is really very hot topic in Israel.
Right. So, and there are complications even in nations that have that same example, that the Lutheran is a state religion. There have been more and more people who are opting out of paying that tax.
Right.
And so then again, the sustainability of the clergy and of the buildings becomes much more fragile. So,
sure.
Yeah.
You have a system like in England where you have what's called legitimate or state recognized religions, which receive funds, some funding. I don't think all the funding they need, but you have to qualify as a state recognized religion.
Right.
And of course, with all the variation of religious groupings, you can imagine, I'm sure that's a sticky wicket.
Right.
Over there too.
Well, and so without those structures and with, you know, various ways, like I say, for our tradition here in the United States as a Lutheran Christian, the passing of the Sunday plate is the norm, and it is the way that sustains the clergy and the everyday needs of the building and the mission and ministry of the congregation. Mm-hmm. And that is the work of the people. We see that as the work of the people. And also the challenge, because I know there are people who've become quite disaffected with the church, with that idea that it seems like the church is always asking for money and always asking for more money and always asking money for this and money for that. And, you know, it's nickel and dimed. And there are lots of pushback responses to that notion of free will offering.
Sure. What I've seen is the whole question of what people expect and value or don't value about religious institutions. So a lot of people who are critical of institutions don't want to feel irritated when they're asked for money, but then, you know, when the reality is that those institutions aren't supported, you can't support clergy. And, you know, so I think there's ambivalence about the role of clergy, if you really need clergy in America, where now, you know, private religion is king.
And you can, you know, download off the internet, you can become clergy with a click of a button.
You certainly can become clergy. You can get access to sermons and religious material on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You can have your own little home group. You can have, there's a lot of what they call deinstitutionalization, or if it's not private religion of the individual or even secularism, what you do see definitely, certainly in Jewish communities, is a decline in the liberal religious institutions where the value of all the matrix of religious life or cultural life is not as important. So take a city like Juneau, where you have probably 10% of the Jews who pay any dues to the Jewish institution. It's not a very sustainable model, and it's not because, you know, the synagogue may be a nice place, but people don't have the value. They don't have a value that this is something that really needs to be supported. You know, it can go two ways, but I think that's a problem not just in Juneau, but in a lot of Jewish communities where the support for Jewish institutions is liberal, I would say. Not so much in the Orthodox world, but in liberal communities is in decline.
You know, I think, too, across a lot of expressions, not just religious expressions, but the notion of consumerism. I used to mm-hmm. work at the university, and there was a moment when we changed from seeing students as students to seeing students as consumers. And mm-hmm. that's a very different notion. There's a difference between I'm paying to come and learn as opposed to I've paid for this, now give me my grade. You know, as it being a transaction mm-hmm. rather than that. And I think there's something about that that's happened in churches as well, that, you know, I've paid for this, and so now feed me, or, you know, my soul, or entertain me, or engage me. And so there's a little bit of that transition from I'm giving because this institution is important and I need to be sustained by this, to now I've paid, you know, give me back something in return.
Mm-hmm. It's like a health club.
A little bit, yeah.
Actually, mm-hmm. sometimes shockingly similar, because health clubs get a lot more memberships than people come use the gym. So people, you know, so I think in synagogues you see membership is much greater than the people show up for services on a normal basis. But people do expect when they do come that the services are engaging for them, and
right.
I mean that's a problem that's been addressed or talked about expectations, but also how synagogues have made themselves like health clubs. You know, so they offer these types of programs as opposed to looking at the spiritual, or helping in the spiritual lives or the ethical lives of the people who are associated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We really want to welcome people to call in, and the question that we're really posing to you is really one of two questions. You can address either one of them. How has your faith or faith tradition shaped your view of money and how to use it? Or the other question is, how has your faith tradition been broken by the misuse of money by religious institutions or by clergy? Or
and you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 463-6455. 463-6455. Feel free to give us a call as we talk about religion and money. What about Scripture? What does Scripture say about money?
Well, there's so many different aspects of what Scripture and in Jewish tradition, what the rabbinic writings say about money. You know, I think that's very important. We talk about how our tradition shapes our view of money is the understanding of charity, the role of charity in our lives and the way we use our money, how we distribute charity, who we give it to, what percentage of our resources do we use for it. In Jewish tradition, both in the Torah, which talks about our obligations to the person who's become poor or been impoverished, several sources deal with that, and it's developed in the rabbinic literature to a very, very extensive degree. So in Jewish law, we have a term for charity. It's actually not a direct translation, caritas, meaning love. In Judaism, we call it tzedakah, which means righteousness or doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what's underlying that principle is that we give money to the needy whether we're in the mood or not. It's the right thing to do. It has nothing to do with your emotional state, which charities is the notion of love in the act of giving, which is a very high level of giving,
mm-hmm.
is not required to fulfill the commandment to give tzedakah. So there's a huge matrix of behaviors and laws around this, and one can argue that in Judaism it's so well developed that many rabbis consider the laws of tzedakah or the mitzvah, the commandment of tzedakah, is the highest commandment. Maybe that along with Torah, the study of Torah. There are laws concerning the amount of resources that you should give to tzedakah. They are both lower limits, that is, you should give more than a certain amount, but they're also their ceilings to how much tzedakah you should give.
Oh, really?
There are, in medieval literature, Maimonides' eight principles of tzedakah or giving are extremely important in our literature. With the lowest level giving grudgingly, but giving to the highest level of helping a person become independent, financially independent.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have a great awareness, and it's about the giving of money. In fact, another beautiful teaching is, since we're not supposed to handle money on the Sabbath day, the last act of how you handle money before bringing on the Sabbath is putting money in the charity, in the tzedakah box, in the pushka, another term for it, so that the last relationship you have with money on the Sabbath, when you're not supposed to think about it, is helping the needy. So there really is a strong emphasis on that, and Jewish philanthropy is famous. Famous amongst philanthropers for its. Its depth and the characteristic of Jewish communities, even when they become very secularized, is that they're very generous to institutions in the broader community too. So it is one of the great teachings around money, and it has so many different. You could really talk about it for hours and hours and hours. It's so interesting.
Well, you know, one of the things as you were speaking that I was reminded of is a conversation that we've had in the midst of our congregation and beyond our congregation is the whole notion of the act of giving and then letting go, you know, of not needing to know that the church is going to spend the money that I've given in a way that I may designate specifically. Mm-hmm. That in fact, that act of giving releases the giver so that the church can do a variety of ministries, maybe even beyond that person's imagination. It may or may not be a way that that person would have chosen to spend that money forward. You know, maybe they didn't want to buy a goat. Maybe they didn't want to help support the church that was the family church that was burned in Ferguson, Missouri after the uprisings there. Maybe they didn't want to buy malaria nets. Or maybe they didn't even know that that was on the radar of possibilities. But whether or not it was their intention to support those kinds of ministries, that was less important than the act of actually giving and being released from it. So it's a little bit like putting it in the box and then not worrying about it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like, I've done the act, and that's what matters. That it's not even the what gets supported out of that. That's less important than my actual willingness to put that in the box and feel good about that and let it go.
I love the term ministry. We don't have a term like that in Jewish tradition. We have a different term. It's called the gemach. It's a gemach is an acronym. Chevrat gemilut chasadim, and it means a society for loving kindness, and you can if you look at, say, you go to New York and look at the list of gemachs of loving kindness societies, you'll find thousands of them for very specific purposes. So there are, you know, in Jewish communities, organizations like the Jewish Federation, where you give a gift and it's distributed, you know, across the board to various different causes.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a principle, there is very finely developed principles in Jewish tradition about triage or prioritization of your charitable dollar. The principle being that you first support those who are nearest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can move to beyond the local needs to broader needs, and then beyond, say, the Jewish community to the general community, and now, of course, global needs. But there is another thing I think it's worth mentioning within Jewish tradition, and that's means testing is totally legitimate in how you give your tzedakah.
I have no idea what that sentence just
meant. It means, is the organization that distributing the money an effective organization?
Oh, okay.
Is it mean that, so if you look at, you know, and I'm in the nonprofit world, and
right.
You look at GuideStar, say you want to see how much money goes into administration and how much money goes into actual services.
We've used Charity Navigator. So
right, there's
another
lots
website.
Of different services
right.
now that
right.
tell you about the, you know, a bad charity is where you have, I think, very high percentage
administrative costs. Yeah.
And much less given to direct services. But even in Jewish law developed 2,000 years ago, means testing was, at least with institutions, certainly understood, whereas it's lightened in terms of the beggar.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases where you're not supposed to ask the beggar, well, are you drinking, you know, and so forth. There are, on an individual basis, there is sometimes a benefit of the doubt, but there even is a question, is it better to give money to a beggar or food, perhaps?
Right.
But all those questions are engaged in the literature. And if a rich person loses all their fortune, there's concern in Jewish tradition that the person not you know, that. How do you give dignity to a person who had a their self dignity was defined as a wealthy person? Well,
right.
You're not going to give charity to make them wealthy again, but
right.
But there's in other words, there's individual consideration as to what types of help would give dignity to that person despite their terrible setback. So it's just there's so much to it, but I think that it's interesting too that there's that you can apply critical tests to how tzedakah works and the institutions that distribute it is a very normative thing within in Jewish culture as well. So let's again. We'll pose the question. We hope would love to get a call and hear your opinions. How has your faith or tradition shaped your view of money and how to use it? And how has your faith and tradition been broken by the misuse of money?
And you can join the conversation by calling 463-6455. It's 463-6455. I think one of the things again, that seems to cause a lot of triggers, emotional triggers, are the ways that money has been misused by financial institutions or by religious institutions and their leaders. We've seen, you know, televangelists who live lives of luxury while they're asking for, you know, the person who can probably not afford it for money to get a handkerchief that's been blessed or mm-hmm. those kinds of things, or you know, the church treasurer that's embezzled money and or just mismanagement of money within organizations. And that goes a long way to creating a real sour feeling for a lot of people in terms of, you know, the church is supposed to be holy, it's supposed to be held to a higher standard,
mm-hmm.
and when those people who are part of those institutions violate financial trust, it seems a different level of brokenness then.
Certainly, I think in a lot of areas of personal, I guess sort of, when I think of personal area of life. We know that sexual scandal also is, you know, very, very damaging.
True.
To people in their faith, and where clergy use, you know, power to abuse. But I think, you know, it's interesting. It's an expression you in Judaism. You can tell a person by their kis, their kos, and their kaas. In Hebrew, kis means pocket, kos means cup, and kas means anger.
Huh.
So the area of money, the area of I guess liquor or addiction, right?
Right.
And the area of emotional how we use our temperaments,
mm-hmm.
our temperaments,
mm-hmm.
are key areas.
Hmm.
That in the text, it's a very old text, a 2,000-year-old text expression. I think it's very insightful because it's not saying anything about religion, but it's also, I think, we can see too our religions. You can apply that to religious institutions. How, you know, keys, the cup, and the cup, the pocket, and the temperament,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. are key areas in which we get a sense of a person, or say of a clergy person, or of a or leaders within a religious establishment. And it's I think it's a wonderful insight into sort of the vulnerabilities of our nature as human beings. And of course, the purpose of religious traditions, or at least their, is to refine our vulnerabilities, right, as human beings.
Right.
That we, if we, money, which is such a corrupting thing, that we use it ethically, that all those possible things that we can get addicted to and distort us, that we use responsibly and modestly, and in our temperaments, that we learn to control our emotions and to live with a certain, I'm going to call it temperamental dignity.
Well, and I do think that there is a tension that we don't want things that are holy to be muddied by the mundane. You know, we talk mm-hmm. about filthy lucre. Why do we have to talk about filthy lucre in terms of, you know, the pastor's salary or making sure that the electric bill gets paid or making sure that trash removal happens on a regular basis? You know, we don't want necessarily these things that matter in this elevated holy way to be so mundane. You know, mm-hmm. who wants to think about the trash bill for a church? And yet, it's a practical thing. You have to think sure. about the trash bill for that. So I do think that there is that dichotomy, that tension of wanting this thing to be holy, to be, you know, floating above the earth and not to be, you know, subject to the practicalities of the earth. And yet they cannot. You have to have the snowplow come. You have to have the sewer bill paid. You know, I mean, all of those things are there, but there is that tension about it, I think.
That, you know, I don't know if it's the same within Jewish, at least the Jewish sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if people think, I mean, in my experience as a congregational rabbi, they were uncomfortable topics, but I think that the sustainability of religious institutions is more of an expectation. I mean, it's not, and there are ethical guidelines, very strong guidelines within Jewish practice around it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we even have a blessing for going to the bathroom. You know, so I mean, there is a, I don't know if there's that type, I mean, I think, not that these topics aren't sensitive, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure that you'd find that same expression of filthy money. I think there's another insight. I think the view, it's the relationship between the material and the spiritual that's important. You know, that within the Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. I think it's often been misunderstood, by the way. One of the really fine book I read by scholar David Nuremberg, it's called Anti-Judaism, and he studies the history of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism, and it sort of developed in the West, the notion that the Jew was only concerned about the material.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's misunderstood is that the material is governed also, just like as the spiritual is governed by law in the Torah. So it's just, there are laws regarding how we use money, and there are laws regarding how we pray. And those are just all part of a continuum. But the problem, I think, challenges is that people, here's another interesting issue, is that the prophets, at least in our tradition, in the rabbinic tradition carried on, saw that you could pray and be the most pious person, but if you didn't handle your monetary affairs ethically, you're not considered a religious person. I mean, a religious person is both, has high ethical standards, and is also practicing what we might call spiritual practices,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they are totally supposed to be totally integrated. So one's meticulousness around tzedakah or how you handle money. I'll give you an example. We talked about this before. Is being responsible around money goes two ways.
Mm-hmm.
So a consumer has obligations and responsibilities, and it's the way it's expressed in the Talmud is that if you've already bought something and you want to go into a shop and just ask the storekeeper how much something costs that you're definitely not going to buy, for whatever reason, whether you're not going to buy, you're not shopping, you're not interested in acquiring it, is unethical because you're taking time away from the shopkeeper. He's dealing with you when he has to make his living selling his goods.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion, it was very concrete within the Talmudic world with a different economy, but the notion of consumer responsibilities along with consumer rights are very much part of the law. So it's seen as a continuum of concern. And is, that's one of the aspects about Jewish law. It's so comprehensive in every aspect of life, just how we try to do the right thing. It's a different sensibility coming out of different culture.
That's really interesting. Because I am, you know, there is a part of me that wonders why we are so reluctant to talk about giving and money. In Christian churches, in Lutheran churches, we talk about stewardship. There's usually a stewardship drive in the fall at some time. We haven't done this at my church because we don't limit it to just this one moment. But the tradition has been that, you know, right around harvest time, right, when people are bringing in their harvest, you start talking about first fruits and you think about, well, all that you've been blessed and all that you're giving. And then you pledge, you know, you give a little card and you say, okay, across this next year, I promise to give this much money. Mm-hmm. And it's an event. So it may last for 2 weeks, and then, oh, thank goodness, we're done talking about that now. Can we move on to hearing the rest of the real gospel? You know, like, so it's been compartmentalized, and it's been minimized, and it's been dismissed then. It's like, okay, now we've talked about the money part, and let's get back to the rest of the real story.
Mm-hmm.
And that does is then it takes away the whole conversation that continued to happen. So by that compartmentalizing and that minimizing, it's become then you shouldn't talk about money. And if you do, then it's that you're asking and you're asking and you're asking, which again turns a lot of people off. They want to just be able to come and not worry about the electric bill or whatever. They just want to come and have their connected holy spiritual experience. And it's a model that might have worked at one time, probably did not work as effectively as we might now look back and think that it did. But there's a lot of trying to break out of that model to talk about the whole of stewardship, of stewarding. It's that wholeness that you were talking about of all the time and all the talent and all of the money, that we make that a broader conversation that happens more consistently across the whole church year, rather than, you know, that week in October right before you hand out next year's offering envelopes.
I don't know if you have this in the church. You can, we have a tradition that you give charity or tzedakah at the anniversary of death, or at milestones, or at what we call yard sites, when we're remembering a loved one. So it's another opportunity to give tzedakah. And so it's actually what I learned growing up, I mean, just as a kid, that all these are moments when you give tzedakah. So there's just, you're giving all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be times of year when you would have, like the High Holidays, you give extra because it was this holiest time of year. And but basically, you're constantly giving. And that's actually a sense of sainthood, that we actually are saints in Jewish tradition. Not only do they model it in terms of money, but they model it in terms of their acts of kindness, mm-hmm. which have no limit.
Right.
So I think it's very common that, you know, what we teach, you know, every time the kids come to school, there's a tzedakah box and they give money, and then, you know, there's an occasion. But you always mark any type of personal occasion with an opportunity to give.
Yeah,
I don't think
that we have necessarily that same, you know, I think of particular, like, little thank offering boxes for right before Thanksgiving. Sometimes during the period of Lent, there would be, you know, a time of So once you, like if you gave up your mocha every day for that, then you'd put that amount
that's
of money.
A big
and
sacrifice.
That's for some people,
especially
that would
in Juneau.
Be. Yeah. But that, you know, at the end, or they also do, you skip a meal. And so you put that amount of money that you would have spent on that meal, and at the end of a certain period of time, you give that money to a thing. So there are like drives or particular times of year, but I don't think there's anything as consistent as what you're talking about. Basically, that pledge is that I will give every Sunday in my Sunday offering.
Right.
And so one of
so
the challenges,
expresses
right?
In that way. Mm-hmm.
And so one of the challenges, and I guess one of the gifts is. There was always in the church year, we would talk about the summer vacation time, because if you weren't there, you didn't physically put your envelope in on that Sunday. You know, you were away traveling somewhere, and so we missed that envelope for that Sunday. So God bless, you know, now direct deposit automatic giving, because that's allowed some congregations to find a level of stability, because there's this regular giving. But the other thing that we've found is that there are certain things that shape that. So once you've said, here's my level of automatic giving, whether you get a raise the next year or you go down in your job or whatever, that remains sort of a fixed level.
Mm-hmm.
And people are less willing to modulate that according to their own income bumps or valleys, which is an interesting thing. There's also the person who's been shaped in their childhood. You know, you put $5 in the plate, because I always saw Dad put $5 in the plate.
Sure.
You put $5 in the plate. Well, today $5, you know, is always good. Anything you give is always a gift and blessing, and thank you very much. But $5 doesn't go as far today as it used to. And one of our jokes is, you know, how come $20 looks so small at the movie theater and so large in the offering plate? You know, so there is this thing about are you reflective about how much you give, and are you open to modulating that giving according to the way that your income grows,
sure.
and making a portion of that. Do you have teachings about proportionality, don't you?
Right. Sure. It's tops is 20%. 10% is great. And, you know, not less than 2%. But that, you know, again, it also a lot depends. You know, the tzedakah in the Middle Ages included what we call taxes today.
Mm-hmm.
So because the Jewish institutions could collect tzedakah, that is, there was always social welfare in the Jewish community, that everyone was expected. Tzedakah, in a sense, again, was not a notion of love. It was a sense of doing the right thing. And so supporting the various institutes for the poor, or burial society, or dowering the bride, all these things were considered important. I think certainly, early on when I came here, I had this talk, which no one came to,
about
Judaism and libertarianism.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I basically just wanted to talk about the history of social welfare in the Jewish community. I don't see how a Jew could be a libertarian, given the importance that what was you didn't call it government, but what were the obligations of the authorities toward the poor? And they were supposed to gather taxes and distribute it so that the poor had a safety net. So that in Jewish sensibility is so strong for that. I mean, even the most, non-religious Jews really have that sense of social welfare as really critical for the community, not just certainly individuals had to be because it was the Torah says that poverty will never end.
Yeah.
But it also says you're obligated to support the poor. So we know poverty is going to never end, so there always has to be social welfare to make sure that then people have setbacks, often totally, look, people have a loved one get sick and they go bankrupt. That's the biggest cause of people going poor.
Right.
You know, there are lots of other causes that are, we have such social inequity now. So the prophetic spirit is really welling up as our social inequity gets larger in this country from just Jewish instruction that's really bad. That's really bad. And we have an obligation to redistribute wealth so that poverty, you don't end poverty, but you soften the impact and allow people to live with dignity.
Well, you've managed to do it. We said we were trying to be as not completely ill-mannered, that we would only talk about religion and money, and now you brought politics into the mix after all.
Any libertarians listening to this? Probably
so much
none.
For our Thanksgiving family dinner.
Yeah. Just talking just straight out of the Jew. There are Jewish libertarians, but not that many. I would challenge them to say, at least out of Jewish sources, they may have other reasons for being libertarians, but I just don't see a libertarian impulse. I think there are other reasons to be distrustful of the government, and there are sentiments like that, which certainly Jews have suffered from plenty of governments. But, it's an interesting notion in terms of the issue of social welfare and how, and I think that is a very... it's just a very strong Jewish conviction.
Well, and there have been what leapt into my mind as you were talking about that was that shift into the 1,000 points of light with mm-hmm. George Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. Talking about how the government is not going to be able to.
Right.
Do all of the social caring that people are going to need and how churches have often been that safety network, mm-hmm. Religious institutions and synagogues and mosques have been the safety net, have done the food pantries, have done the clothing closets, have done the soup kitchens and, all of those kinds of things that it is through the giving that people
right.
give to us as institutions, as churches, as those places where people can go when they do have a social need that, the government structures may not always
right.
meet those particular needs. Our church has a food pantry. It's open 5 days a week, and we serve a significant number of people every month. Of
right.
people who cannot make the ends meet, even as they're working, even as they're taking in their grandchildren, even as they're looking for employment, even as housing is unattainable for low income people in Juneau, that we are a bridge for that small portion, and then they go to a different church for a different kind of bridge or support, and
mm-hmm.
and truly that the giving so many times it is hard to say, well, I don't want to pay for the pastor or I don't want to pay for the electric bill, but in order to be able to do the ministries,
mm-hmm.
to do those social network things, we need people to organize and places to organize out of, in addition to the generosity of people. And our food pantry is supported not only by our congregation, but by community people who say, I've been looking for some place to be able to support, so can I bring in this food and these kinds of things. It's critical. And we serve a very critical function by having people to organize and a place to organize out of, and then the generosity of the food
absolutely.
Donations themselves.
It's so important. And I think that's really part of a central role of religion, of religious institutions when they're functioning at a high level. That they are galvanized support and awareness and the practice of generosity and charity.
But part of that struggle, too, is that it can be very wearying.
Oh,
it's hard
yeah.
to see the same level of need or the need increase and you know, the resources become more strained and it's wearying to see that level of need that remains and worsens. It is a hard ministry to do, even in the midst of the gift of it.
It's hard, too, because it doesn't necessarily always... I mean, people sometimes are sensitive around seeing poverty up close. And, you know, I remember there were, when I lived in Seattle, you know, when they were trying to find places, homeless mm-hmm. areas for homeless communities to live and house certain communities, really across the board, we're very uncomfortable, and even we don't want it in our backyard.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, there's a certain, you know, I mean, that's always a challenge. I think that the day-to-day challenges of being of providing tzedakah and how you bring dignity to people and support them in a time when they're ashamed. Some
right.
people, especially if they had a change in circumstance, it's a tough issue, but that's how to do it and do it sensitively, but also to do it responsibly.
Right.
So I do think, you know, it's, again, I think a part of the political debate, and it's an honest political debate, is how do you empower, if in Jewish tradition, empowering a person to become independent is something that is, it's the highest ideal. So then you would want to not, you know, not create a sense of total entitlement, but that
right.
people, that you create incentives for people to take responsibility if they can put themselves back on their feet, or, you know, all those things. So there, I think that's, there can be legitimate debates around money, of this type of money issue within a religious institution.
Right.
Are you making people too dependent? Are you too harsh? Are you not allowing enough people to be served? These are legit. Those are sometimes very difficult issues to work through. And our society is facing, you know, a big issue around money and inequality.
Right.
You know, these are really hard issues. And
so to take it from these sort of grand platforms
mm-hmm.
back down to a very personal level, when you were a little kid, how were you taught to give to your synagogue?
Well, in terms of how to give in general or how to give specifically to the synagogue?
Well, okay, how to give in general. How are you shaped? How are you molded by your religious tradition in giving?
Well, obviously parents and how they model it. My grandparents were very active in their synagogue and gave of their time and of their money. They were of modest means. And I know my grandfather was honored with the Red Velvet Kippah Award at his synagogue.
Oh, there's a
story.
I'll
tell you what, he looked like the Pope. But yeah, but he, you know, he was very active and raised money and really helped, you know, promoted tzedakah and more on an institutional basis. And so that was important. I mean, I knew that was important. I knew that putting money in the charity box, we did. We had a charity box at home. And I remember a story when I was a young rabbi, I was walking to the synagogue for Friday night. The Sabbath begins Friday night, and you're supposed to... And I realized I had coins in my pocket,
uh-huh.
and I'm supposed to get rid of the money.
To carry anything,
so
right?
I'm living in Santa Monica on Main Street, which anyone's been down there is, that, at that time it was starting to really develop, and there are a lot of stores on Main Street. I'm walking synagogues further down toward Venice. I'm going into every store. I says, "Do you have a charity box?" And none of them did. I went to store after store after store after store, and they didn't have a charity box. Because I sort of knew that I had to get rid of the money, but I wasn't going to. I wanted to give it away to
right,
a charity.
Right.
So I was so shocked. So then I think I called March of Dimes, on after the Sabbath. I said, can you give me a bunch of your charity boxes so I can go down to shops on Main Street so they have something like this? You know, so it was. That's what I learned from my family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's something. Mm-hmm. I mean, even something as simple as just having to get rid of change on Friday before the Sabbath. So I knew that I had to go to a. That's the time definitely to give charity, but people weren't making that opportunity easy.
Right.
That's the key. You want to make the opportunity to give easy, and not easy, but accessible and frequent and normative. So I credit my parents. Thank God, may they live till 120. with that sensibility, and it further strengthened by my learning. You know, certainly everything was reinforced and greatly deepened by the wonderful learning I did in rabbinical school and elsewhere about that tradition. As far as religious institutions go, I think that I've seen a lot of wars on that issue over my rabbinic career, some that have directly impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that I served a congregation in Seattle a long time, and the big war there was over a plaque for the people who gave to the Capitol campaign.
Right.
And there were two sides fighting it out. So I says, we shouldn't have a plaque. We don't want to honor people who gave more than people who gave less. And how do and then the other people say, but if you don't honor the people who give, then they won't give.
Right.
And that whole argument, it was terrible, terrible, terrible. And congregation was split, and I was sort of caught. I had to. People looked to me to give an opinion and lead, but it didn't matter. they were so set in their views that I got. It was really a unfortunate
thing. Well, there's not a way
thing.
You can win. That is one of the frustrating things when money becomes the center of an argument in a group of faithful people. There's no way to win.
There is no
argument.
Way. It hurts the community, and and often people have difficulty compromising because they have very strong opinions, especially about recognition and honoring people for their gifts and equality of being the equality of recognition so those are very sensitive topics, very sensitive topics, I'm sure, in churches as in synagogues. And
it's an ongoing question in seminary for seminarians is, as a pastor, do you look at who gives how much, or do you not, keep track of who gives how much in the congregation? And I'm the person who says I don't want that particular kind of information. Some use it as a way of ministry, like if somebody's giving suddenly falls way off, is there something going on in their life? And I just depend on those around me to help clue me into those kinds of things, because I really don't want to know what individual members give or don't give. That's to me, it's not helpful to me as a pastor to know that. I just ask, can we pay our bills on a Sunday? And that's enough for me.
Yeah, it's a tough issue for clergy, even for those who are not clergy, which is most of everyone listening.
Right.
It's a tough issue when a congregation goes through a struggle like that.
Right, right.
So
any great final word, some wisdom to wrap up here as we come to almost the top of the hour?
Well, I'll end with a beautiful expression you'll see on many pushkas, many charity boxes in Jewish homes. It says, Tzedakah matzil me'mavet. Translated charity. Charity saves from death. A meaningful life of giving is integral to, it's synonymous with religious life. in my opinion.
What a blessing. Thanks for that word, Dove. Thanks for listening, everyone. This is Sue Belita. You've been listening to One Lutheran, One Jew, One Hour. And stay tuned for more programming from NPR Public Radio.
Exactly right. That's what we want. That's what we need. But the challenge is going to be, can we pass on to the younger generation the expression of that rage like...